My name is Sean Farrell, and I'm professor of history at the College of St. Rose. And we're here today on Talking History to discuss the Great Irish Potato Famine. In so many ways, the famine is a watershed event of the modern Irish experience. But of course, the famine's impact cannot be confined to Ireland itself. It's an event that had truly Atlantic dimensions, as this traumatic experience poisoned Anglo-Irish relations, and massive emigration led to the creation of large Irish emigrant communities in the United States and Canada. Today, however, we're going to focus our attention on Ireland itself, where the famine left 1 million dead and 2 million men, women, and children emigrated in search of a better life on foreign shores. Today, we're going to discuss these matters with James Donnelly, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of a recent study entitled The Great Irish Potato Famine. Jim, obviously the Irish famine is central to both the Irish experience and the Irish-American experience. I guess I'd like to start by asking you what would motivate you to tackle such a subject in your research?
As you suggested, the famine is the greatest cataclysmic event in Irish history, with 1 million dead and about 2 million emigrating between 1845 and 1855. So it is the most important demographic event in Irish history. So it really demands attention.
What were some of the issues that are the ways in which this outpouring of scholarship in the mid-90s kind of reshaped or affected your thinking to take on some new subjects?
Yeah. It allowed what I regard and have always regarded as the central issue of the Great Famine, namely the question of the responsibility of the British government, to be viewed from a number of different angles. A lot more work, for example, had been done on the subject of immigration from Ireland in the period since the end of the 1980s. And there were a couple of ways in which that contributed to a new perspective on the famine. For example, though nationalists always decried immigration from Ireland and the idea of government-sponsored immigration, there's no question that immigration was a release and a safety valve for those who were able to take advantage of it. So it was a kind of disaster relief for those who were afflicted by the famine. And it's been calculated, for example, that if the British government were to have spent £1 million, that would have been sufficient to secure the emigration of about 100,000 people. And we know that the British government absolutely refused to undertake any large-scale scheme of assisted immigration during the famine. And this was motivated by, at least in part, by the government's reluctance to become involved in the functioning of the economy and society in a direct way. It was part of the laissez-faire economic doctrine of the time. And with immigration going on at a great rate privately, the government felt that there was no role for the state to step in and assist immigration. But in fact, there was a role for the state there, and if the state had seen fit to undertake that role, it would have been possible to greatly reduce the number of famine deaths.
There is a tension, I guess, between the claims of laissez-faire doctrine and yet British policy at times was quite interventionist. I'm wondering if you could talk to the inconsistency there of principle and effort.
Well, there was certainly inconsistency between some of the actions and the economic principles espoused by the British Whig government of the time. On the one hand, during the winter of 1846-7 and the following spring, the government engaged in large-scale relief measures of its own. There was a vast system of public works, which employed almost 700,000 people at its peak in March of 1847. This was followed by a vast distribution of free food under the so-called soup kitchen scheme that ran from March to September of 1847. 1947, and at the peak of that, some 3 million people were being fed soup rations at the soup kitchens that were established under government auspices around the country. What needs to be said, I suppose, about that massive interventionism is, first of all, that it was relatively short-lived, that for the Whigs it represented about a year's worth of activity in 1846-7. And then the government stepped back from that kind of massive relief, partly because it violated in such a dramatic way their economic doctrines. The idea, for example, of feeding directly a very large proportion of the Irish population violated all of the Whigs' economic principles, and though it might be tolerated, for a single year on the grounds of dire necessity, the government was unwilling to stretch its economic principles any further than that. And so we see that withdrawal from direct government intervention by the autumn of 1847. And from that time on, the responsibility for the relief of distress in Ireland is shifted from British onto Irish shoulders. There was a saying that was very popular in British politics in early and mid-1847, and that saying went, Irish property must pay for Irish poverty. Irish property must pay for Irish poverty. And here the notion was that the Irish had to be taught self-reliance. They had to be taught to stand on their own 2 feet. And so British politicians and British government ministers insisted that Irish tenant farmers and Irish landlords really needed to assume the fiscal responsibility for the relief of distress in Ireland.
While not trying at any length to take the Irish landlords off the hook at all, surely there was a recognition on government officials in their mind that Irish property could not in and of itself handle a trauma of this magnitude, a problem of this magnitude and scale.
Well, that too is an interesting observation of British attitudes toward Irish landlords in the late 1840s and before. And I think the best way to answer your question is to say that British politicians and ministers were of two minds on this question, and they were trying to hold together two contradictory attitudes on this issue. On the one hand, they regarded the landlords as primarily responsible for creating the social conditions that had brought on the famine in the first place. They also saw Irish landlordism as socially and economically bankrupt. They recognized that a large proportion of Irish landlords in the late 1840s were on the ropes financially. Yet, at the same time, they were determined that Irish landlords should not escape what they regarded as their proper fiscal responsibility. And so there was a tendency to think that Irish landlords were always playing the poor mouth, saying that they were much poorer than they actually were. And the British felt that they could stand to bear a lot more fiscal responsibility than they were willing to admit. And because the British were so anxious to offload that fiscal responsibility onto Ireland, they had a tendency in the end to overestimate the capacity of Irish landlords and the Irish land system to bear the fiscal weight that the British state was now placing on it.
And I think one of the things that remains so controversial about the famine in Irish American and Irish eyes is this question, it all comes down to this question of blame. And many people continue to believe in this concept that this is not a famine as much as this is genocide in some way. How do you respond to this question, this issue of genocide and the famine?
A very important question about genocide, because the interpretation that the famine was genocide, that there was no real famine but rather an artificial famine, has been the central point of the nationalist interpretation of the Great Famine since the time of the famine itself and continuing on thereafter for many decades. I've always felt that the basis on which the standard nationalist interpretation has rested was entirely erroneous. One central prop of the nationalist interpretation was the argument that there was more than enough food in Ireland to feed the starving population if that food had been retained in the country. So the nationalist argument goes, the British government allowed very large quantities of grain and other agricultural produce to be exported from Ireland during the famine years, thus depriving the starving population of the food that would have carried them over this disaster safely. Now, that interpretation is entirely erroneous for several reasons. First of all, the food gap that was created by the loss of the potato was enormous. On the eve of the famine, the potato provided about 60% of the food needs of the Irish population. And the total potato failure of 1846 essentially wiped that out in one go. So there's no question that this natural disaster, which was caused by a deadly fungus called Phytophthora infestans, that there was a natural disaster that created a huge food gap that could not have been plugged even if all of the grain that was grown in Ireland had been retained there. And that's true not only for 1846-7, but also for subsequent years. On the other hand, what nationalists always neglected to mention was the fact that beginning in the spring of 1847, there were huge imports of grain from mostly from North America, from the United States and Canada, and that these really dwarfed the exports in magnitude, probably by a factor of almost 3-1. That is to say, the amount of food imported into Ireland in the late 1840s exceeded the amount of food exported by almost 3 times. And in fact, I think historians are now coming to believe that probably by late 1847, the beginning of 1848, there was actually a sufficiency, an overall sufficiency of food in the country because of these really gigantic food imports, enough food to feed the starving population if that food had been distributed to those who were in greatest need, namely the agricultural laborers and the smallholders in the south and west of Ireland.
What are some of the other issues that historians have focused on in revising, I guess, this traditional nationalist interpretation of a genocidal British policy with regard to the Irish?
At the end of the 1980s, there began a controversy among Irish historians about the way in which the nationalist interpretation of events had been treated. At that point, at the end of the 1980s and then continuing on into the 90s, there was a feeling among many historians that for a period of 50 years or so, during the rise of Irish historical studies as a professional discipline, that historians were engaged in a constant tendency to downplay certain aspects of the nationalist interpretation, particularly a refusal on the part of many historians, it was felt, to face the catastrophic aspects of Irish history in the early modern and modern period, the English conquest of the 16th century, or the Great Irish Rebellion of the 1640s, or the Great Famine of 1845-51. So there was a feeling that in the professionalization of Irish history, there was a lack of engagement with the nationalist and populist understanding of the Irish past. And as a result of this feeling that many historians had grown distant from certain realities of Irish history, other historians began to take a fresh look at issues like the Great Famine or the Rebellion of the 1640s or the English conquest, and to try to close the gap between professional history on the one hand and the nationalist and populist understanding of the Irish past on the other.
And your book, then, I'm taking, is kind of an effort to, at the end of the decade, take stock of a lot of that work. Do you sense in looking at Ireland and the Irish American community, for lack of a better word, that there really has been a change in the way they interpret the famine, that the traditional nationalist interpretation has been affected whatsoever in the last 40 or 50 years of famine scholarship?
Well, in some respects, it's been a hard slog because the nationalist interpretation is really riveted on the Irish popular and the Irish American popular imagination. This is especially true here in the United States, where if you talk about the famine with Irish American audiences, you immediately encounter the bedrock nationalist interpretation that the British presided over the robbery of the Irish poor of their food at the time of the famine, and that there was a deliberate set of British policies that were designed to bring about or brought about the extermination of hundreds of thousands of people. And it's a very emotional feeling at the popular level, sometimes in Ireland and very often here in the United States. And therefore, one often finds that the trotting out of facts, as we historians understand them, doesn't immediately dispel the emotional reaction.
I was struck in rereading the last couple of chapters of your book by your ability to put it in that kind of more balanced context. On the one hand, disavowing this genocidal interpretation, but at the same time, reiterating the fact that the richest nation, empire in the world, allowed 1 million people under its rule to die.
Yeah. When you look at British policy in Ireland in the late 1840s, you just see a whole string of policy failures. There must be at least a half dozen major ones that could easily be ticked off. I mean, it starts with allowing the export of a large quantity of food in the winter of 1846-7 before foreign grain imports began to arrive in large quantities. It continues with paying a rate of wages on the public works that was simply too low to keep up with the escalating price of food, so that even on the public works, by the end of 1846, people were dropping down dead because the wages that they were receiving for their labor weren't sufficient to allow them to buy the food that they needed for themselves and their families. Earlier, we talked about the soup kitchen scheme, which was remarkably effective for a period of 6 months, but then the government disbanded it after it had, in effect, proved its effectiveness and its cheapness. And then there was the reliance on the poor law system as the principal means of providing relief for the famine-stricken population of Ireland from the autumn of 1847. And with that particular system, there were a whole series of obstacles that were placed in the way of people who were in distress, preventing them from getting timely access to the relief that they needed. We also mentioned before the unwillingness of the government to undertake large-scale assisted immigration. I mean, that was a specific policy decision. They decided against doing that after having discussed it. So, you know, the landscape, the political landscape of the late 1840s is just littered with a whole series of, misperceived or grossly inadequate responses by the British government to the famine crisis in Ireland.
It seems that the root of all this is an insensitivity, certainly, to the human suffering of the subjects of the government.
Yes, an insensitivity, and this is really where imperialism and colonialism comes into play in a significant way, because the British governing classes and the upper and middle classes in England at this time held a whole series of attitudes, the result of which was to consider Irish Catholics almost as a lower form of life, certainly as socially inferior. And that imposition of a socially inferior status on Irish Catholics meant that the humanity and the generosity that one might have expected simply was not there, nor was the political will there to do what needed to be done. The Nobel laureate Amartya Sen has said that famines are almost always preventable if the political will exists and to mobilize government resources. So the question then becomes, well, if the political will did not exist, what explains its absence? And I think in the case of Ireland, as in the case of India, let us say during the Bengali famine of the 1940s, which Sen has studied, it wasn't a question of there not being enough food available. From late 1847, early 1848, there was probably a sufficiency of food in the country. The problem was to get it properly distributed to those in greatest need, and that required government taking a mobilizing role. Why didn't government do that? Well, partly because in the British case, famine fatigue had already set in. The British upper and middle classes were beginning to turn away from Ireland as a very unpleasant reality. They weren't willing to stay in the game for the long haul. And part of the reason for that was a lack of sufficient human sensitivity and fellow feeling with Irish Catholics. Irish Catholics in the British Protestant mind were alien and the other. And this contributed to the breakdown of the political will to do what was would have been effective.
And it was also, I think, buttressed, I suppose, by an interpretation of the famine as God's will, providentialism.
Providentialism has increasingly been seen, along with laissez-faire and that set of prejudicial ethnic attitudes that we were speaking about before, as one of the most important factors in helping us to understand the inadequacies of the British response. What needs to be remembered here is that British Protestant evangelicalism in the early and mid-19th centuries contained this very strong providentialist strand or streak. So the famine was seen in the eyes of many British evangelical Protestants as an act of divine judgment against Ireland and Irish Catholics, in the sense that God was almost issuing a decree which said that the current Irish land system and the foundations on which it rested were entirely erroneous and they needed to be replaced. And this providentialist view held that God also operated according to the laws of supply and demand, and that what needed to be done was to allow the free market system to operate here, which meant, in effect, the crushing of the potato subsistence economy in Ireland and the elimination of as many of the myriad of small holdings as possible. Another way of thinking about this is that God was giving his blessing to the creation of a capitalist order in Ireland on the model of British agricultural capitalism that seemed to be functioning with great efficiency and success.
So I'd like to thank you, Jim, for coming and speaking with us today.
It's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me.